This is Inside Isla Vista on 91.9 FM, KCSB FM, Santa Barbara. I'm Lisa Osborne. It's great to be with you. First week of spring quarter here. You might notice a little bit of a change in the KCSB schedule, but Inside Isla Vista is still coming your way Wednesdays at 5 o'clock. Coming up a little bit later in the show, a UCSB professor who has ties to Isla Vista has been awarded the Pulitzer Prize. We'll tell you about that coming up. But first, April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, so we wanted to check in with Brianna Conway, who is the director of the Campus Advocacy Resources and Education Office, also known as CARE, and her office is in Isla Vista. Hi, Brianna. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Lisa. Thank you for having me.
Well, April, Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and you have been doing incredible work all year round with students and residents of Isla Vista, so we appreciate you coming in today because part of preventing sexual assault and becoming more aware is knowing what it is. You know, sometimes you think this, okay, I was raped by a stranger, that's sexual assault, but really it can be more nuanced.
Absolutely. I think, you know, when we talk about the importance of April and this month around continuing the community dialogue. And I think over recent years, we've seen a big shift in the way in which people are feeling open and willing to talk about it. But that being said, there's still a lot of shame, a lot of stigma and silence that come around these issues, particularly silencing of survivors. And so April can be a really great opportunity to re-engage in that community dialogue. We also say that there's a really big difference between awareness building and prevention education. So awareness is that we can all engage in a community-based dialogue so that we're knowledgeable about the impacts, the myths, things that you just talked about with a stranger assault. But education is more focusing on how are we stopping violence before it even starts. So how are we engaging in the community safety and empowering individuals of the community to prevent and intervene and stop the violence before it starts. So our efforts really seek to achieve both. We want to always continue the dialogue and make sure that survivors' voices are heard and felt in solidarity, and always maintain our educational mission of ending this and creating a culture where violence is no longer accepted or tolerated.
We're going to be talking about some of the events that are happening this month, and some have already happened, so hopefully maybe some of our listeners have already participated. But what do we need to know as far as education goes around this topic of sexual assault?
That's great. So throughout the month of April, we are putting on our Pillow Talk, which is Communicating Affirmative Consent Workshop. And that's really a primary prevention education-based effort and initiative. So we have four sessions. We still have three remaining for the month of April. And those are going to take place in the Women's Center Conference Room in the Student Resource Building. So those are on campus. We also have a number of events in Isla Vista as well. But the Communicating Consent is a peer-led effort. So actually all of our programming for the majority of April are supported by our student. We have five undergraduate CARE peers, and they conceptualize the ideas for the events that they want to do, balancing prevention and awareness and survivor healing, and put together a really robust calendar of events. So it's really their dedication, their efforts, the commitment that they've made to educating themselves to become experts on these issues, and then rolling out a robust effort of programming.
Well, what I noticed about it is that self-care is involved, is in the topic or the title of a couple of these events. So maybe talk about the importance of self-care if you're a survivor of sexual assault, why we have to be good and eat gentle with ourselves.
Yeah. You know, and I think, you know, self-care can have a lot of different definitions for a lot of different people. And when we view the experience of violence as a traumatic experience in which something has occurred to us that we could not control, that can leave us feeling a sense of hopelessness, a sense of powerlessness. And the way in which healing and self-care is to really work to start in rebuilding those, doing some things that are good for ourselves are going to make ourselves feel like we can go to class in the morning and really work on the incremental steps of healing is a really important component. There's also a real sense of isolation. I talked about the silence of this. So when you've experienced this trauma, it can feel really isolating and that you're alone and that no one knows what you're going through. And so community-based events, whether that's through meditation or some of our art-based or our yoga as healing, which is actually led by a trauma therapist who's certified in yoga and the specialized form of yoga for trauma, can really be a time of reinforcing that you're not alone, build solidarity and community, as well as taking some of those well-being and nurturing steps for yourself.
So I'm thinking about the trauma, and someone who's listening might not even be a student, but perhaps this happened to them, sexual assault, years ago, maybe a long time ago, maybe not that long ago, but I would imagine some of the trauma gets buried. Yeah. And what about the trying to heal yourself after keeping things buried for so long?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, sexual violence is one form of trauma, and we know that traumas throughout the lifetime can sometimes start to stack up on one another. And sometimes the way in which to heal and cope and to get through the day is to stuff it down. And the ways in which to really addressing trauma, whether that's through counseling or seeking the support of loved ones, really centers around feeling believed, decreasing the isolation. You know, oftentimes when trauma occurs to us, it's more likely that the closer we are to the event, so whether that's the person that hurt us or the community that it happened to, that we live in, that can increase the trauma symptoms and increase the sense of betrayal. So we talked a little bit in the beginning about, you know, kind of that myth that sexual assault can be viewed as a stranger jumping out of a bush and attacking someone. And what we know is that that's really not the case. And that's not the majority of over 93% of sexual assaults are committed by someone that the survivor or the victim and the perpetrator knew one another. So they had some sort of nexus of connection. So that can be a friend, an acquaintance, can be a husband, a wife, a lover. And so we know that the relationship dynamic is what can really impact someone's feelings of more intense trauma symptoms.
This is Inside Isla Vista on 91.9 FM KCSB. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and I'm speaking with Brianna Conway, who is the director of the Campus Advocacy Resources and Education Office, the CARE Office. Her office is in Isla Vista, and there's a bunch of events planned for this month surrounded around this topic. And why don't you give out your web address now, and we're still going to continue to talk.
Sure. So it's wgse.sa.ucsb.edu/care. If you Google UCSB Care, will be the first one that pops up.
And on Facebook, too, you have a Facebook page, too.
We do, at UCSB Care for Facebook and Instagram.
So the last time you were here, I guess it must have been a year ago, because Sam Bean, who was a student at the time, she wrote a cover story for the Santa Barbara Independent about Isla Vista and the whole kind of, was it rape culture that she called it?
Right.
And between that coming out a year ago, we also have had the Me Too movement. Are you noticing some of the clients that you're seeing are triggered by these stories in the news? I'm just wondering how sexual assault survivors are impacted by what's happening now, because in a way, it's safer to talk about it, that some of the perpetrators seem to be being prosecuted. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it might bring up a lot of memories.
Yeah, so I think, Lisa, exactly what you represent is a little bit of the challenge. Anytime a story or an effort is highly publicized, that can have a lot of impact. And so at the CARE Office, we try and really balance our educational and awareness mission with our survivor services. So how are we putting survivors at the center of everything we do? That's what the research calls is a trauma-informed approach. So how are we creating opportunity for survivors to feel safe when they're consuming media or social media and things like that? But one of the things that I feel the publicity and the narrative has done is really mobilized providers. So that's in, you know, the CARE Office is only one office, and we're not going to solve this systemic-based problem by ourselves. And so you'll see in a lot of our programming and in our efforts that this has really got to be, we have to engage community stakeholders. We need, you know, everyone to have a seat at the table in helping us address these issues and addressing them for specific target populations. So one of the things that we're also doing this month that's been launched is the hashtag #WeStandWithSurvivors. And that was a three-series social media campaign that was put on by the Isla Vista Safe Committee. And that's a commission that's headed by Joyce Dudley, our district attorney. And what we did was we created three different videos, 60-second videos, one for addressing the barriers that survivors might feel in talking to law enforcement. So it's a law enforcement video. The other is a district attorney video, and that's to really combat the myth or the feeling sometimes that survivors, I don't want to report because nothing will happen. And so it's a reaffirmation from our district attorney's office that they're committed to prosecuting these crimes. And then the last one is really around significant others, friends, loved ones, and the importance that their words and actions have on whether or not a survivor takes those next steps towards their healing. So if I tell my best friend and they don't believe me or they question what I was doing that night or say, are you sure, and create doubt, then I'm less likely going to seek the help and resources, and I'm more likely to do what you talked about, which is bury the trauma and the pain and really stunt my healing process.
This is Inside Isla Vista. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and Brianna Conway from the UCSB Care Office is here. There are some statistics. Nearly 1 in 2 women and 1 in 5 men have experienced sexual violence victimization other than rape at some point in their lifetime. And it brings up the question, what is sexual violence? Like we said earlier, it's not a stranger jumping out of the bushes and raping you necessarily. It could be subtle, and I'll bet that it could be repeated over time as well and perhaps escalate. Maybe it starts with a touch that just doesn't feel quite right.
Yeah, Lisa, you're absolutely right. I think, you know, there's going to be different systems that have different definitions. So there's going to be the criminal justice system, and they're going to have a very specific definition. There's going to be campus-based policies, and that's going to have a specific definition. The care office, you know, we come from the place of helping first and foremost and creating culture change. So our definition at CARE is going to be the most broad, and sexual assault is going to be any form of unwanted contact that's in a sexual nature. And contact could be, you know, sexually based verbal contact or sexually based images. You know, it doesn't have to necessarily be a sexual act. The care office also provides services for survivors of domestic and dating violence, which we really define as any pattern of behavior within a romantic relationship. And that could be a marriage to people that have maybe just started talking. But in those behaviors are really where one partner is trying to have power or control over the other person. So just things that could constitute an unhealthy relationship, extreme jealousy, manipulation, intrusion on privacy, things like that. And then stalking is the last form of violence that we provide services for. And that's really going to be any pattern of behavior that's directed at someone that makes them feel in fear or uncomfortable. And so oftentimes that is often used around technology. And perpetrators use social media and repeated forms of communication to really intrude upon someone's boundaries. So if we can look at these all as personal boundary violations, and that can be a whole, you know, kind of continuum of behaviors can contribute to these forms of violence.
So when someone comes into your office, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're like about to call the police and file a police report. I would imagine that might be a small amount of cases, or how does that work? And how do you work with clients? Are you only working with those who are specifically just affected by sexual violence, or is this a counseling service such as CAPS where your clients or patients can come back over and over?
Yep. So those are two really great questions. I think what we know in the field is that when victims and survivors are feeling supported and believed, they're more likely to engage in reporting-based processes. So coming to CARE, we can help facilitate that readiness and eagerness if they're feeling that way. We also know that these are the most underreported crimes. You know, I would say less than a quarter of our cases choose to report in the formal law enforcement-based reporting. The other thing that we know is that we're not often the first people someone discloses to. People are going to most likely disclose to someone in their social circle that they love and trust, that feels safe for them, than necessarily an office on campus or in Isla Vista. Eventually, I think they find their way to us either through referrals from those friends or from other staff members or things like that. And then we can kind of lay out what all of their rights and options are. It's never an advocate's job to say what someone should or shouldn't do. It's really my job to say, these are all of the options. This is the menu. And it's my job to support you while you process that and weigh the pros and cons. But ultimately, I support whatever decision is right and best for you. And given that we're a confidential resource on campus, similar to CAPS, we can do that. So there's not, Coming to Care isn't going to start a reporting process to the university or to law enforcement. It can really just be that safe haven that we can start as the starting point and let them know what their rights are. And then they can choose what options feel best for them.
And I know the CAPS office, the psychological counseling office here on campus, is extremely busy. And I've just heard it's hard for students to get appointments, and they are continuing to hire more psychologists. How does your office operate? Can someone continuously come to you over and over, or is there a limited number of sessions?
That's a great question. So, you know, CARE and CAPS really work in close partnership with one another, but the services are different and our structures are different. So in the CARE office, we also have a 24-hour confidential hotline for survivors to call and seek support 24 hours a day. We accept walk-ins for new appointments and appointments via our website. Typically, the way in the structure of our caseload is that we are able to see clients, if not same day, they'll have an assessment with someone and then probably scheduled within the next day. But oftentimes we can see people the exact same day, particularly if they're a walk-in and they have never been to our space. We don't have a session limits, and everything that we offer is free. And then from there, what we do is we really take a tailored approach. Advocacy tends to be very action-oriented, so I always kind of describe it to clients as we're like rolling up our sleeves and figuring out what life processes or what life needs you have right now as a result of your experience, and how can I help either facilitate difficult conversations or move through some of the red tape that survivors have to face, versus counseling, which is going to be more about the long-term healing, emotional processing, psychological well-being. Oftentimes, a care advocate and a CAPS clinician work in tandem together. We have a team of psychologists at CAPS who have identified that this is an area of interest. They're led by the interpersonal violence specialist, Dr. Kelly Lantrip, on campus. And so they're a group that are like the primary referral, so survivors maybe can get connected in a way that's a little bit more meaningful or a little bit around the standard operating procedures of CAPS by really being connected and matched with a psychologist that maybe shares their identities or meets and has this trauma-based work as their professional passion as well.
And even though you're in Isla Vista, are you only serving UCSB students because you are part of UCSB?
That's a great question. So we are, our charge is students, staff, and faculty, and we do have our location in Isla Vista, which is the Gaucho Support Center, which is on the second floor of the Isla Vista Community Services District building. And then we have the women's our office space in the Women's Center, which is in the Student Resource Building. So students, staff, and faculty are our charge. That being said, I've been doing this work for over a decade in community-based agencies. If community members are feeling impacted and reach out to CARE first, we're never going to turn anyone away. We're going to support. We receive funding from federal dollars that allow us to serve everyone. So it's not a limit based on your affiliation. That being said, a campus resource might not be the most appropriate. So that's where we have really strong partnerships with the local rape crisis center, which is called STESA, Standing Together to End Sexual Assault.
And we've had them on the air. They just did a whole training for volunteers.
That's
so
great. Yeah. And they too have an office location now. This is new in a partnership with the Isla Vista Community Services District to have an office location where they can see clients out in Isla Vista as well. So I think, you know, we can always be a starting point for anyone in the Isla Vista, Santa Barbara community, and then we can kind of make that needs plan on who's best to keep serving this person.
Well, it's a really important topic. And when we spoke, I guess it was over a year ago, you were talking about how, a report had come out from the Sheriff's Department that said that sexual assaults were up, in part because there were more being reported in Isla Vista, and you didn't necessarily think that that was because there were more incidents. It's just that the victims were becoming more comfortable with reporting. And we also, I think, spoke at one time over the Stanford student who assaulted another student, and he was given a light sentence. Mm-hmm. And did you tell me back at that time that when students are onboarded here at UCSB, that there's some training that they go through to learn about that yes means yes, no means no?
Yes, absolutely. So we have kind of two tiers of our prevention education. One is the mandatory, which is for all incoming brand new students. So whether you're an incoming transfer student or an incoming first year, you go through three different phases of education during orientation. Receiving materials about the law and the policy around what our definition of consent comes in a written form. And then prior to your arrival at UCSB, you complete an online educational module. And then within the first about 6 weeks of the fall quarter is when we run a program called the Gaucho FYI program. And that's a hybrid of education between alcohol and drug, mental health, sexual violence, and then this year we've just added diversity, equity, and inclusion-based principles. And really the goal of Gaucho FYI is to present, these are four major issues that impact members of our community and how are we setting the community standards early on around what is and isn't expected and how do we want our community to function and that we want it to be one that has safe alcohol use, that we have, you know, the resources and support if someone's feeling like they have mental health concerns. And then how are we ensuring that we're preventing violence before it starts and creating people to be able to be bystanders to intervene if they see situations that could become risky or could eventually escalate to a form of violence. And so that those are the three major components of education that happen right in the beginning when students are acclimating to campus. But the care office's responsibility is really beyond that as well, right? That's what the laws say we have
right.
to do.
But at least they set the standard
yes.
here. Because if they grew up in a household where right. there was domestic violence or they got away with whatever they got mm-hmm. away with, you know, being the popular kid in high school or...
All of those things are important that we really set the tone right at the beginning around this is not... That's not what we do here. And we're all going to have lived experiences that are going to contribute to how we think and behave about these issues. But then how are we engaging in education? Not all at that, you know, at that beginning. And how are we integrating it into the classrooms and into the awareness months, you know, each quarter? And how are we, you know, continuing the dialogue with certain populations that there are more specific? How are we engaging in the dialogue on a peer-to-peer? There's research that indicates that students are more likely to be receptive and learn information if it's coming from a peer. So that's why we have the staff members at the care office that go through really intensive training about how to talk about these issues and can be messengers of this message within their peer network and their peer group as well.
And you mentioned that you're working with county partners. The hashtag We Stand With Survivors is what you're going to see on social media this month and hopefully beyond, too. Yeah. So what are some let's wrap up with just some other events the 24th next week. We're going to be wearing denim to raise awareness of.
Yes. So Wednesday, April 24th is the 20th annual Denim Day. This has been something that the state of California has now been celebrating for 20 consecutive years of wearing denim to work and to school in solidarity with survivors. It came out of a court ruling in Italy over 20 years ago now, where a judge blamed a survivor for wearing tight jeans as contributing to the cause of her assault. And so this is an opportunity for the community to say that we don't victim blame, that it doesn't matter what you were wearing, drinking, or doing, that never gives someone permission to your body. And so a way to show solidarity and that you hold that value is to wear jeans to wear denim. On next Wednesday, April 24th. The day before that, we have an event in Isla Vista outside the Pardal Center, which is a partnership with Standing Together to End Sexual Assault. That's going to be from 11 to 2. It's just going to be an affair of awareness and showing survivor solidarity, writing notes to survivors. Tons of free giveaways. We have mugs. We have T-shirts. We have all the care stickers and buttons that we have, all squeezy stars that you'll see around campus. And so those are the two main things that we have coming up next week as well.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming in, Brianna Conway. And let's get the Facebook page, UCSB Care on Facebook. And then your web address one more time?
Is wgse.sa.ucsb.edu/care.
And that's Brianna Conway, director of the UCSB Care Office. Thank you so much for coming in and raising awareness. And just to point out, this isn't necessarily a man-on-woman crime. This can happen so many different ways.
Absolutely. Well, we know that the rates of violence affect women, men. They exist within the LGBTQ population. It doesn't discriminate against any form of racial identity either. And what we know is that those that tend to be traditionally marginalized, I don't always necessarily like that term, out in the community are more likely to experience multiple forms of violence and oppression, and that sexual violence is a form of violence and oppression. And so when we have multiple identities or intersecting identities, the experience of it can be more difficult and painful, and then access to resources become even more difficult, and there's more barriers that those individuals have to face in order to overcome the experiences of trauma.
Well, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Lisa.
And you're listening to Inside Isla Vista on 91.9 FM KCSB. I'm Lisa Osborne. As we wrap up the show tonight, I wanted to let you know that there's an Isla Vista connection to the Pulitzer Prizes, which were handed out this week, recognizing the excellence in journalism and literature. Our UCSB professor of Black Studies, Jeffrey Stewart, he is actually head of the Black Studies Department, chair of the Black Studies Department. He is the author of the book, The New Negro, The Life of Alain Locke, and it's a definitive biography of the father of the Harlem Renaissance. Well, Jeffrey Stewart has won the Pulitzer, 2019 Pulitzer, for his biography. So congratulations, Professor Stewart. Now, you might recognize Jeffrey Stewart's name as he's the namesake behind Jeffrey's Jazz Coffee House, which pops up in Isla Vista every once in a while. And it's an experience for people of all ages to come and enjoy live music and to kind of get a feel for what it would be like to be in a jazz club of days past. And Professor Stewart came on Inside Isla Vista a while back to talk about the inspiration for Jeffrey's Jazz Coffee House, which started right here at UCSB.
I was teaching a class on history of jazz, and that class focuses on the way in which music erupts in certain spaces. So I particularly look at New Orleans and New York, and particularly the clubs and cafes. So we were talking about Paris and how that the Paris clubs in the 1920s and 30s were tiny little clubs in which people clustered together to hear these amazing musicians, and there was very little space to enjoy the music, but something magical happened because of that. And one of my students said, oh, like Isla Vista. Obviously the premium nature of space, the congestedness, but also the creative vibrancy of Isla Vista. And so that led me to think about, I wanted basically to give students a sense of what it's like to experience jazz in the settings in which most people consume live music that's jazz. And so I was able to find a way to get one of the cafe owners in Isla Vista to put on these evening concerts where local musicians who are jazz musicians would come and play, and the class would come and listen. And then over time, more and more people who were just walking by or whatever began to come. And so this time, another professor, lecturer actually, George Blake is teaching the class, but we're still doing the Jeffrey's Jazz Coffee House because it has its own sort of audience. So that's really very, very confirming for me that that's happened. But I think it also relates to the way in which Black Studies, which is a department I'm in, conceives of itself as not being an exclusive Black issue or formation, but a place where lessons learned from the Black experience can be extended out and into other communities. And in particular, in Isla Vista, at times I say there's almost like what people would normally call a ghetto, where you have one type of people and they're sort of squished together and there's a lot of liquor stores. I mean, that's kind of like Isla Vista, yeah? But at the same time, we try to re-theorize about those places in Black Studies. And so I'm looking at these places as not ghettos, but actually crucibles of creativity. And that's what I see Isla Vista as. It's a place where you have diverse populations actually coming together, creating a sense of community that is more varied. You know, sometimes it's kind of wild, but sometimes we need a little wildness, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we need some
a controlled
energy.
Wildness is
yes,
nice, too.
Yeah, something that's not, you know, out of a hand. And, of course, also this got momentum after the tragedy in 2014 when we recognized that there are significant divisions and conflicts going on and that we needed to have a space where people could come together, you know, enjoy music, but also have conversations that might alleviate some of the more negative tensions that are often operating. And now with the Salsa Night, we're also trying to acknowledge that Isla Vista has a significant Latin population, Mexican population, that Afro-Cuban music in particular is so integrally connected to jazz. It emerged in the 1930s and 40s in New York in connection with and dialogue with jazz. It's been a tremendous force in jazz, Afro-Cuban music, although often relatively invisible in the typical histories of jazz. So we wanted to make that visible, but also try and use that as a way to make visible the richness of the community that exists in Isla Vista that is not necessarily a UCSB or SBCC student. You know, as one person I was talking with said some of the people who live, students who are in elementary, junior high, they say, we're students too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that we need to be able to find a way to connect with those students. So this is really just the beginning of a process of trying to connect with diverse communities within the community of Isla Vista through music.
That's Jeffrey Stewart describing how he came to develop Jeffrey's Jazz Coffee House in Isla Vista. It's a pop-up experience. It happens every once in a while. And you can go to the Facebook page, search Jeffrey's Jazz Coffee House. Like the page to find out about upcoming events. Doesn't look like any are scheduled now, but I'll also keep you posted on upcoming episodes here of Inside Isla Vista here on KCSB. So Professor Stewart has been awarded the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for his book, The New Negro, The Life of Alain Locke, the father of the Harlem Renaissance. Congratulations, Professor Stewart. Thank you so much for tuning in to Inside Isla Vista. We have sports coming up next, right after Climate Connections here on 91.9 FM, KCSB.